Okay, well, we will go ahead and get started. To begin, if you had did not get one of the charts and explanations last week, I have some extras here this week, so I can get those to you. But did anybody have any feedback, any questions from that? It's okay if not, but anything? Was it helpful? Okay. Well, just as you guys continue, if you have any feedback, especially for the explanation page, let me know. I'll have these up here. So afterwards, if you didn't get one last week or want to come up when we're going to break up and get a little bit more interactive here, do some role playing today, you can come grab it. One thing I said that I'm not sure if I've said as explicitly here when we were at Carmel on Wednesday was just kind of how it strings together that chart, sort of almost in a sense in reverse. And so I'll say this, and hopefully this will be helpful to show how all of these things fit together and why they're so important. So in the end, I would say, the core, the most essential part of what I believe about Christianity, that I'm forgiven of sin, that I'll be united with God. That's the core claim. And so I'd say that I believe because Jesus said so. That's it. So the core of Christianity, why do you believe that? What is accomplished is because Jesus said so. That's by faith. There's nothing else. It's only by his authority. Nobody can go check it out. Nobody can verify. I know there are the claims of going to heaven and at near-death experiences and all of that. So we could maybe deliberate that a little bit. But still, you don't know. Even if we would grant the people who have had that happen, they still don't know how do you have sin forgiven. Like they still don't know that sin is forgiven, right? So there's only one authority that would know that you could be forgiven of sin, be united with God forever, and that is God himself or someone with the direct authority of God, which is what Jesus claims. So why do you believe you're forgiven of sin, that you'll be with God forever? Because Jesus said so. So the next question, if we do a logical progression, is, okay, well, why do you believe Jesus? And I believe Jesus because of the miracles he did, namely his resurrection from the dead. Okay? So then the question that would follow from that would be, well, how do you know he actually raised from the dead? And now we're in that historical, talking about that historical, trusting the eyewitness testimony of the apostles. So I'd say because there were many who saw him and wrote about it and told us that they saw him previous, they saw the crucifixion and they saw the resurrection. They saw him after he was raised. Okay? So then the question is, well, why do you believe those people that are telling you about that? Right? Does that make sense? So why do we believe the eyewitness testimony of the apostles is really what you could summarize that as? And the answer there is going to go into a combination of the things that they write that you wouldn't really include if you were making it up. Also, the things that they were willing to endure or lose because they were preaching this message now. So there's a lot there that you don't see a lot of ulterior. There's really no room for ulterior motives, right? They didn't get rich. They didn't get powerful. They didn't get women. They didn't get any of the things you typically see. Network contracts. And especially if we contrast that with other religions, Mormonism and Islam just provide a really good backdrop here for if you compare the apostles and what their lives were like or became like versus, say, a Joseph Smith or a Muhammad and what their lives became like. Now, not saying they didn't have trials, okay, Joseph Smith and Muhammad, but you see them accumulating the types of things that worldly people try to accumulate: power, wealth, women. And that's probably not a coincidence. It's just an indicator to me that it's very human. Whereas in Christianity, you sort of saw a reverse where people started to give up the worldly things that typically would be what people are after. So you have this reverse. So start was, I believe, forgiven of sin in heaven because of Jesus. I trust Jesus because he rose from the dead, performed other miracles. I trust that actually happened because of the eyewitness testimony of the apostles. I trust their eyewitness testimony because of the things they endured, the things they include. And then the question is, okay, well, you're just getting that from the Bible. So why do you trust that you have what they actually wrote down? That's kind of our next step. And so that's why we have to be at least somewhat familiar with how did we get the Bible, that we're going back to early manuscripts, that there are hundreds and thousands of manuscripts spread out over a large geographic area.
In contrast to
Not only other religious documents, and so you take like the Quran, and what's the gap between the original writing of the Quran, supposedly, and the earliest existing manuscripts. And the Quran is what, 850 years later than the New Testament? 650? Okay. Yeah, that's right. And I think that what it is, I'm getting confused. I think the earliest existing manuscripts, I think, are 600 years later. So the book, the Quran, comes in history 600 years later, 500-something years later, but the existing manuscripts are a gap of about 600 years, I believe. And someone help me remember, or somebody else maybe even knows this, but we can get an exact number on that. Contrasted with the New Testament, which is written earlier, and yet the gap between existing manuscripts and the originals is less than 125 years for some of the very earliest. And we have an entire complete, I think, 215, something like that, years. I think it's Sinaiticus Vaticanus. Is it Vaticanus that is the first full manuscript? I'll have to get that as well.
Sorry.
I'm forgetting which one it is. No, that's okay. That's a good question. I just can't remember which one. The first full one, I think, is 250 AD, is the first full entire codex without anything missing. Now, it's not a problem that some of the others are missing. In fact, a gentleman who teaches here in town, James Kruger, up at RTS, is one of the foremost experts on canon and early scriptures. And what he shows is that a lot of these partial ones, they know that they aren't just a random, like this was just one piece and it didn't exist in anything, because they'll have one section or they'll have one page, but it has page numbers on it functionally. And it'll be like page 164 and 165. So while you don't have the rest, it's pretty easy to say, okay, well, obviously there was a lot before this. This was part of a larger collected work. And so what he shows is, even from the earliest manuscripts we have, a lot of those demonstrate that they were part of a large codex that was most likely some compilation similar to what we would have of the New Testament today. And so it wasn't uncommon, even in the early church, to have a lot of this together. So that's how we know that we have what they wrote, that we have it hasn't been changed. And I think, you know, I don't know of really any experts that disagree strongly about a total corruption of the New Testament, that are historians, academics, even non-believers. They at least are going to say, yeah, like generally it's reliable. Where there are the differences, they're very minor. And for us, the secular, the atheist historian isn't going to care about this, but for us, theologically, no minor or major points are in any of the sort of questionable text. Of the small parts that we're not sure, was the sentence supposed to be there or is it not? Did it get added? None of those affect any doctrine. So we're not believing anything on the basis of one of the minor parts of questionable text. Good. So they might, there's a difference between doubting that they're true and being able to say, I've proven that these are corrupted and we have no idea what the original said. So because you're not an atheist historian saying, yes, this is what Paul wrote in Romans. I don't find any dispute with any of the words used here. Like, I think I have every historical reason to believe this is the original version Paul wrote, or, you know, close enough with translation, right? But that's different than saying, I believe everything he said. It's saying it's been passed through history accurately. That doesn't mean it's true. So the atheist historian is going to look at what Paul wrote and say, okay, this tells us something interesting about the time and this thing. Maybe he even thinks Paul had invented it. But as far as what I'm talking about with manuscript reliability is he's just saying, yeah, this is what Paul wrote to this letter to the Romans. And what he wrote originally, we have an accurate version of it today. So some might accept that. So again, how many Muslim scholars you would have that are sort of New Testament historian experts would be, I guess that would be the question, is how common are those and where? So like if you go to whatever the top religiously Muslim schools in the world, then of course that's going to be very different. But like, let's just say if you had here in the U.S. someone who just happens to be sort of Muslim upbringing and they're, that would be a different scenario than someone at, what's the school in Egypt that's the, it's like the most preeminent Quranic school. Anyways, there's a University of Cairo. Anyways, so yeah, that would be a different scenario between those two. But all we're talking about here is, with the documents, is did they get passed through history in that we have them the way they were originally written? And so you could not dispute that, but still say, yeah, but I don't believe any of it. It's all made up. It's just we have what he made up in the beginning. Or I think some of it was made up, some of it's real. And then they might have ways of saying that, trying to discuss what are the things that were forced in there. Paul, were you going to? Right. In the yeah, early on that there were things. Right. So that's different. Okay, so why do we believe we have what the apostles wrote? Well, that's because it's been passed through history. We can look at this, and again, now we're doing kind of history and looking at documents. How do we assess whether a document's been preserved accurately? And this is a really big deal because for a lot of texts, you're talking about a gap of hundreds and probably even 1,000 or more years. And so they have to try to be able to figure out, has this been changed? Even well-known works, you know, the writings of Plato, Aristotle, the histories of Caesars, a lot of these more seemingly innocuous, just sort of historical documents, there's a big gap that they're relying on this. The earliest version we have is in 1000, and it was written in 200 BC, and the earliest version is 1000 AD, and we have to trust that it wasn't changed, and there's not a lot of dispute in that. Now, there's some at times, but it's pretty well accepted. And the amazing thing we have with the New Testament is not only way more manuscripts, but such a small gap, relatively speaking. And so it's not enough time, I think there can be this, the C.S. Lewis used the term chronological snobbery, where modern people can tend to think of ancient people as sort of ignorant and stupid, and a lot can be built off of that. But even if you didn't have the internet or whatever, they had advantages that we don't. Their memories were far better. They could pass things down much more accurately than we can. Any of you that have worked in a verbal culture would probably have seen this. Where it's not, there's not a lot written. So even let's say 250 years, let's just say we didn't have anything. That's still actually a relatively short time for significant fake things to be just thrown in left and right and accepted by everyone and nobody knows. And in fact, the things that did start to get added in as it went along, there was a lot of dispute about that because the people knew that wasn't there. And so anyways, all that to say is we have very early manuscript evidence. A lot of it is very, very close, especially something like, say, from John, because it was one of the last books written, and yet we have some of the earliest manuscript evidence for it. So the gap there is extremely narrow, easily within the lifetime of a person. So a person could have read, could have interacted with John and been reading from some of the existing manuscripts that we have. So how you could force something, you just can't, You can't fake something. You can't add. Legend doesn't have time to take over at that point, especially, again, on core central things. So that's kind of the chain of how it fits together from I trust Jesus. Why do you trust Jesus? Because this is what he did. How do you know that's what he did? Because this is what these people said. How do you know that's what that what they said they is true? Well, here's why I believe what they said is true. Well, how do you know you even have what they wrote? And that's what they said, and here's how we do that. And so that's how all of this fits together. And I'm not saying most anyone, there probably are some people, but I don't think many people come to faith by going through that whole process, right, that way. Most people haven't even thought about it. But functionally, whether we realize it or not, that's why most of us actually believe. Because let's just even say, well, you just heard the gospel preach, you heard when you were a kid, you heard the Bible taught. Well, okay, you're still getting it from the Bible, so where did that come from, right? So even if you haven't put it together in this way, that is why you have come to believe. What I'm trying to help us to be aware of is when we're talking from the when we're interacting with someone who's not a Christian, it's very reasonable for them to ask us any of those questions. And in fact, we should want them to, because we don't want them to accept the Book of Mormon, just because, right? We don't want them to accept the Quran just because. So we shouldn't want them to accept the Bible just because. Even if we know it's different. I know the Bible is different than the Quran. I know that it's genuine. That doesn't mean I can just say, oh, well, no, it's different, so you just need to believe that, because that's what the Muslim would tell them. It would say, you know, that this is the most beautiful book ever written. There's no way a man could have written this poetry by himself, that he was illiterate. It's not possible he could have written it. So you have to just believe it, right? We're going to say, no. No, there's all these problems. Well, it's very reasonable. Not only very reasonable, we should expect and say, in fact, not only are those problems, but we have a book that doesn't have those. Let me tell you, you know. And so that's the mindset we have to get into, is that it's not only okay for people to ask these questions, but we should be encouraging it, because we want them to be that judicious with false teaching. But they don't know false teaching from real teaching unless they went through the process, right? And so that's why we're putting it together in this way. And that's why it's really important. Right.
But I think we need to strengthen the knowledge that it's not just the short time period, it is the overwhelming sheer volume.
Right.
There's not another ancient manuscript system in existence on the planet.
Right.
That even approaches the sheer volume.
Right.
Of the New
Testament, right. Yeah, and so that's why, so you have a system of checks and balances, because the more manuscripts you have, the more ways you have to check errors that might have crept in, because you could, you know, and especially if they're spread out geographically, because today it's not a big deal for, you know, something that we're teaching here to end up with someone, you know, anyone in the world could click on our website and download this, whatever, and they could start teaching the same thing, right? So that's not that impressive if it showed up in Cairo, Egypt. But at that time, when you didn't have that kind of communication, for a manuscript to get to a place like Alexandria, where we have manuscripts from early the early church, and Greece, and then maybe further into Asia, that's, if those three areas, the manuscripts are pretty much all the same, well, you can't just say, well, they were probably all written the exact same time. They would have to go back to an earlier central source to, in order to get out to all those places. So where they're in unison, whatever was the source of all of those had to be even earlier. And so you can push it back and say, okay, there was a pretty good size gap that must have been the original source for all of these others ending up out here. And so you get back to, okay, they had this in a fairly uniform way very early on, in order for these manuscripts to be pretty much identical in all these different places that are very far apart, relatively speaking, especially for that time. Because it still was difficult. Like, it wasn't, again, paper wasn't as common. That while there was writing more commonly than often is understood, it's not like you could just go buy a 99-cent notebook and you could just write whatever you wanted all over the place. And so a manuscript was very valuable. And in fact, one of the reasons that sometimes I've heard, so some scholars that will take, maybe will reject the again, those minor differences when they're quibbling over which one do we think is the accurate. It seems most reasonable to say, okay, well, whatever the earliest one is, that must have been. So if we have one manuscript from AD 125 and one from AD 185, well, most likely the 125 is more accurate. And that could be a general rule. However, one of the things that I've heard said is that because those manuscripts were so valuable, it's likely that if there, let's say a church had four copies, and they knew one of them had an error, then they would be most likely to send the one with the error off and keep the three that don't. So I've heard some theories that actually they would go against the one that, because especially like the ones that went to Alexandria, the climate was better. As far as I understand, I'm not an expert in any of this, so I'm kind of just relaying things I've heard. Yeah. but the climate can be better, so you have some text preserved from earlier times. But the question is, are those necessarily the accurate where there are those minor differences? And so anyways, it's just an interesting process. But again, I think most experts, whether they're really conservative or not, are going to say we have 98%+ accuracy in transmission. And so it's not a major aspect that we're talking about here. And we have, just numerous manuscripts all over the place, full ones, partial ones. Some of the partial ones clearly part of something larger, and so we have a good reason to trust that. So, so that's really really important for us to think about and to understand why we're going about it this way, why that chart is so significant, and why it builds like that. And so, what I thought we could do today is start to try to actually put this into practice a little bit. So we're going to switch things up a little from what we've normally been doing, and we're going to partner up and just ask each other. We'll take maybe 10 minutes, 10, 15 minutes at a time, and then we'll come back together. But we'll start out just trying to explain what Christianity is to our partner. So kind of role play scenario. So whoever's going to go first doing most of the talking, the other person just asks them, so tell me, what is Christianity? And then you take the time, you try to summarize it fairly succinctly. So don't try to take 15 minutes. Try to do it in like 5 minutes or less, but hit on those major points and see how you do. Maybe even if you guys, enough of you have notes, if I was thinking, I would have tried to bring a bunch of notebooks. But maybe take notes or mentally take notes of what the person is saying that you can relay back to them. Because what I want to do is, thinking about our time with Kim and with with Emily, is they're often not really saying what they mean. And so we want to practice, well, let's get to where if we get in those situations, we can at least say what we mean. But you have to have thought through it. You have to have practiced it. And so for me, role playing is always a little awkward, but I think it's really beneficial. And so, you don't have to get too crazy into, I guess there are some of us who might like theater and those kind of things that really like getting into that. If you're more like me, just give it your best. And you don't have to get too far into the role-playing, but just think through how are you going to explain it. And so again, break up into twos, maybe spread out a little bit if it's too loud around you. And person one, ask person two, what is Christianity? Take 5 minutes or so, try to explain it, and then flip roles. And then we'll come back together. So very simple start, just what is Christianity? And see how you do. Try to be thinking about, for your partner, try to be thinking about words they might use that are Christian words that a non-Christian might not understand. So also be trying to take note of that for them and say, it may even be, if it's bad enough, say, you know, what does that mean? Because, again, we're all in here are going to know those words, but try to be thinking about that for your partner. What are the words they're using that a non-Christian might have no idea what that means? few more minutes here, and then we'll come back together. So kind of wrap up. All right, raise your hand if you're dying to have another minute or two to finish up, or if we could come together. All right, sure, yeah. I'll try to get one that's not so bent. There you go. And that's a draft. I'm going to be improving it, so before our last session or down the road in a couple of weeks, I'll give you an improved version. And we're going to make one that's more aesthetically pleasing as well without so much just text on that first page overwhelming. But yeah, set them side by side, and the text page kind of explains the chart step by step. So, and the whole idea was that builds from the that I'm showing that we're not demoting faith by saying it comes after a historical understanding of Jesus or a scientific understanding of the world or whatever, but that first we're coming to know those, that's how we know things about God and about Jesus. And only once we understand about Jesus can we have faith in Jesus. But what we were seeing in the videos was they were trying to say faith was the foundation of everything, but then it wasn't based on anything. It was just sort of my own, I've had this personal thing. Well, then how do you deny someone else, right? And how do you explain it? And so faith is really more an extension of other things. It's not a foundation for, you don't believe Jesus existed by faith. You believe it by history. You believe things Jesus taught by faith because you know he was real, because these things. So it's not a demotion of faith. It's a proper understanding of what it is. So anyways, we can talk through more of that as you have questions. Oh, did I? Sorry. Okay, so how'd it go? How comfortable did you guys feel? Sort of? How were we in being concise? Yeah. How about using Christianese words? How many people struggled with that, or did we do pretty good? Pretty good? Yeah. What do you mean by that? Exactly. And that's what's good in these scenarios. So question that. Don't be afraid. This is the time to expose our failures, okay? Better to expose them in here in safety than out there when we really care about, you know, getting the truth to someone. And so that's good. That's really, really good. What are, if people are willing, go ahead, Paul. Right. 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 Mm-hmm. I'm noting this because this is a great idea. I'm going to say we can do this here. I'm going to put our team on it, kind of collectively, all the places we're at right now. But thinking of a whole list of words that Christians use that are probably not understood accurately or at all by other people, maybe even Christians, and then what's the replacement word we could use that's going to have a more generally understood meaning? I think that would be really valuable resource. So I don't want to forget that. So I'm going to write this down here. So I think like holy perfect might be a good, that just off the top of my head, right? Right. Righteous, that might be, you know, if they understand that, that's probably a borderliner where I think they would understand, but yeah, that right. So righteous indignation. Yeah, that right. It can have is the same way. So apologetics, the number one place the word apologist is used in our society today is in sports talk radio. And what people will say is, I'm not just trying to be an apologist for my team or XYZ. And it's in a sort of derogatory way where it's like, I'm not just defending them because I just want to defend them. So that's the way the word apologist is used in our vocabulary today. So that's not a very helpful word when that's the sort of the common usage. Well, one, most people don't even know it at all. And where they do, it sort of has this negative connotation. In the same way, yeah, I think righteous, I mean, it should be a good word, but I think it almost has more of a negative connotation nowadays instead of a proper, healthy, to the outside world, right? Oh, you just think you're righteous. You're more righteous than I am.
It's associated with all the negatives of religion misuse.
Right. False religion. Or it's when we use certain words, then it's explaining them as we use them rather than just using them and assuming. Like, because we don't have to always reject a word, but it's, you know, a lot, you might say, like, let's take righteous, for instance. It's saying, you know, that you may have heard people say, well, God is righteous, and there can be a misunderstanding of that, but here's what that really means. And then we can explain them, give them the definition of it. So it's not on outright, we don't ever use these words, but it's either we don't use them, or if we use them, we have to explain what they actually mean, because we know there's most likely a misunderstanding. Go ahead, Paul. Right. Right. It's meeting them where they're at. Right. Right. Use. Exactly. Yeah. Very good point. Yeah, exactly. It's not that we want to get away from the core. It's how do we communicate that? It's meeting that person where it's at. And going back to what I said in that if you give the gospel to someone who doesn't have a context for the gospel, if you say the words of the gospel, you know, that Jesus came, died for your sins, died for the forgiveness of sins, and was resurrected and raised that you could be united with God forever. If you say that to someone who doesn't understand any of those things, my contention, again, personal contention is you did not give them the gospel. You just said a bunch of words. They didn't understand any of that. So they didn't receive the gospel. They heard a bunch of words that were confusing and didn't make sense. They didn't get a message out of it. Yeah, like a glossary. Sure, sure. And that would be good too. Like, right, like having a simple way to explain those. So that would be another thing that goes with it. Yeah, context too, right. 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 Right.
They're
going to
come in with very different.
Right. Or even when I went to South Africa several years ago with Mike Willenborg and a few others, some of you guys know Mike, we were with predominantly white Afrikaners at a university, college students, and then we worked in one of the townships outside of Johannesburg, but it was with certain set, I can't remember all the people groups that were comprised there. Then we ended up going over to the east part of South Africa and had time with Indian, not Native American Indian, but actual Indian, and there it was largely word of faith. We were around these Indians, just totally caught up in the word of faith movement, and then we ended up going and working with Zulus out in the bush. So even in one trip in South Africa, which you might think a little bit more generic, you might think white and black, and that's, but it's actually a lot more than that. And we ended up with all these, I mean, very, very different systems in this one trip, and it was really interesting. So, yeah, I mean, that's all around us, but it's everywhere you go. There's going to be those variations. So it's not, you have to learn everything about everything, because none of us are going to be able to do that, but it's about learning how to ask those questions and being in the mindset of, okay, this person may not understand this way. And even that, and asking questions to say, do you understand, or what do you understand that to mean, is going to be really valuable. It's not that you have always have to have all the answers. It's that you need to be thinking of, who is this person, what are they understanding, and finding that out. And then you may get to say something where you don't know how to explain it, or you don't know how to answer, and then you can say, you know, I don't know, let me look into that, and you can follow up. But you're at least asking and making sure, I'm doing everything I can to make sure this person is at least understanding whatever I have to give them. And that's a big start. That's a really good start. What were common themes or common ways, for anyone who's willing to volunteer, you were trying to explain? What were some of the common themes that were coming out in your explaining of what Christianity is? Segments, or, yeah, what were your high points of what you were trying to talk about? Okay. Right. Okay. Yeah. So George's saying to you start out, figure out where are you at with the person you're talking to, and then build up from there rather than just starting and assuming they're somewhere. So that's good. What else were common things that you were talking about? Okay. Realizing we're all sinners. And that can be tricky to understand. What exactly is that? So how would you go about doing that with someone who you're not sure they even understand what sin is?
Well, I tried to convey to them that we're all sinners, myself included.
Good. Right.
Not necessarily George, but an experience I had last summer. I was witnessing to a fellow that I work with, and he thinks I'm a really good guy.
Right. Right. Yeah. When it comes to this, we're all on the same level. I mean, we can look at a human and say, okay, this one's better than that one on a human perspective. But in the grand scheme, that all flattens out, right? When we compare to God, the difference between humans may look like this, but once we put it on the God scale, that goes so small, the differences are.
I tried to convince them that, myself included, we're all born into sin.
Right, right. Now, while also the one thing we don't want to, and I'm not saying you did this, but the one thing we do have to try to account for is it is better to live rightly, right? It is better to sin less. It's just that doesn't earn us anything, right? But it's in response to what God's done that we do that. And I think there is eternal benefit to that, but it's not we earn salvation. It's we have been saved, therefore we do this because we want to be more like God. So yeah, trying to find that balance of, we don't want to make it so much, we don't want to become, Pelagian, where sin doesn't matter.
He needed to be saved
from what? Exactly. Why?
Why?
Yep. Yeah, the why. That's very good. Anything else?
A lot of people around the world, particularly in the West, think of sin in terms of external acts.
Right. I've never killed someone, right? How many times have you heard that? Right.
It's very important for people to understand that external act is only the external manifestation of the inner truth.
Right.
They sin between their ears.
Right.
They are sinful between their ears.
Mm-hmm.
And if nobody ever saw them do anything wrong, just like
right.
that guy's friend, his colleague,
right.
never saw him do anything wrong, and so assumed he was a good guy.
Right.
You know?
Right. I think one of the ways you can say this, and I've used this, I know other people who have as well, we might have even talked about it in here, but saying, you know, okay, well, just let's imagine that I could read your thoughts, and I followed you around everywhere for 2 weeks and just wrote down every single thought that you thought. And then I got up and did a news conference and started to read that. How comfortable would you feel? You know, and everyone's going to go, no. So see, and you, then again, it's important to do what you're saying and saying, I'm the same way. Like, that we're all in this boat, right? None of us are as good as we look on the outside. And many of us don't look good on the outside. And even that's not as bad as it could be, right? And so we're all in this together. It's not us versus them. We're all in it together. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. Right. So that's where I think if saying, trying to test and see if she even thinks, like, do you think you're perfect? Do you think you ever do things that are wrong or hurtful to people? And most likely people are going to eventually say, well, I mean, I'm not perfect. And say, okay, well, that... what we're saying is if the standard was perfection, that you could never think or do or say anything wrong, that would you hold up to that standard? You know, and imagine just even, and then maybe taking it down and even, you know, how we should act towards one another, even just being nice. Do you ever fall short of that, of your expectation? And then if it took it, then I would go to the thought experiment. Okay, just imagine, so here might be a way to understand it. Imagine I could read your thoughts and wrote down everything you said, and then how comfortable would you feel about me revealing that to the world? And at that point, I think most everyone is going to start to get it. Like, okay, well, yeah, I mean, I'm not that. Like, I wouldn't want you to be able to do that. That would be scary. So that's what we're talking about is, you know, whatever, you know, that word sin can often have odd connotations, but just if you don't even live up to your expectation, and there's a God who's perfect and eternal and all of this, then how much further do you fall short of what would be his standard of perfection? But he's not condemning us merely because of that. It's not over. That's the whole reason Christianity has this message of redemption, and this is where we have to show the grace side. So yes, there is a judgment. There is a side where sin is the problem, and it's not that God just says, oh, well, who cares about sin? God cares about sin. And does something, but it's what he does. Okay, Paul's about to step in it. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Because if I'm answering the question of what is Christianity, I'm not sure in the first 5 minutes I'm talking about sin.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like, so here's a question. Is my goal to convert this person after 5 minutes? Because I recognize sin is fundamental to the adherence to and the acceptance of the gospel.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That may be a way to talk about sin, but then it's off of that person.
Right.
And it's on the whole of humanity. Right,
right.
But I don't know that I'm talking about, and I could be wrong, but I was feeling that same thing. Like, I need to communicate with this person because they're going to die in 5 minutes. And
Right, you're right. Turn or burn. Yeah. Yeah, what I was telling Ken, I haven't had the opportunity to do this. But when I have this situation, the next time I have a situation close enough to this one, what I kind of want to do is say, so I've done parts of this before. I've never quite put it together in this way. But first saying, okay, well, so the core of Christianity is really built around Jesus. Are you familiar with Jesus? Have you heard of, you know, Jesus from the Bible? And what have you heard, or what do you know about him? And finding something out there and saying, then, you know, what do you understand to be sort of the bigger message of Christianity, or do you have any? Just what have you heard? You don't have to be, not looking for right or wrong, just understanding where you are. What have you heard Christianity is? And now, if I could get them to answer those two things, now I have a really good basis for how I'm going to respond in everything else. And I do think it can be helpful if you had this opportunity and you had this open door. I'm going to try to get as much of it in as possible in a way that's going to fit them. And so I'd want to talk about creation, fall. Now, not literal 7-day, we're not going to get into all, but just that there was a beginning, God made it, and that there was a fall, and then that Jesus, the whole thing about Jesus is because of that fall, right? And so I'm going to tie it back to, remember we were talking about Jesus, and this is why Jesus is so important. Well, there's a context, and so I'm going to try to fill in some of that context. And then so what? Okay, Jesus came because of that context, but so what? What does it accomplish? And then talking about, you know, and so I think there's an evangelism method that does that, where it's creation, fall, redemption, restoration, I believe is the pattern. I think they draw it out. I'll look into it. I know someone who had used that before. And I think it can be a good basis. I think a good mentality to get into is learning about what are some of these tools or systems that have been developed and not, okay, this is my one I go to every single time, but having them as tools in a tool belt where, okay, this one fits in this situation, so I'm going to use it. So I think something like that can be really helpful because it just walks through kind of the basic story beginning to end, fills in some of the detail. But I would start it in talking about Jesus so that we don't get caught up in, if they say, you know, want to get into a debate about evolution or whatever it might be, you know, I'm going to front load and say, really, the core of it is about Jesus, but here's why that fits, here's why that matters so much. And it might give me a little more of a way to avoid getting in the weeds on that unless it's absolutely necessary. So I don't know, maybe that fits what you're saying, Paul, where we're not just shoving in their face, like, here's the things, like just starting out without any context, without any, it's asking the question, learning what is the context we have with this individual person, but then still trying to have in mind, I want to try to cover these main things. And they might be a little different for you, but, you know, something along that line of creation, fall, redemption, restoration, you know, add or take away what you will. But that would be the general flow we need to, because you have to have a context for what's it matter. Why did Jesus die? That has to, and what does it accomplish? Those two questions have to be answered. And so we have to have something about the fall and sin, separation from God. And that might be a way to say it, that we're separated from God. And then what's accomplished? So what's the cash value? Going back to in the beginning when we said, where did you hear that? You know, what's the source? How do you know it's true? And then what does it matter? Those are reasonable questions for someone to ask of any claim. It's particularly a claim that says it has eternal consequences. So, other thoughts? Go ahead, again.
Yeah, I think I'm liking that better than my initial idea. Initially, I just want to give the big picture of what everything is in context and so forth. The thing that's wrong with that is that it is a lecture format.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
You're asking an honest question like Anthony on the video.
Right.
He's not asserting that there's no God. He's asking questions.
Right.
To push someone into domains
Right.
But start with Christ and ask who he is, and it's much easier to follow all the potential paths by asking questions as opposed to making assertive declarations that they may want to then argue.
Mm-hmm. Right. Right.
You know even better where you need to go.
Right. Matt? Oh, sorry. Someone over here. Oh. Okay. Okay. Right. Yeah. Right. So what you're saying is just that he's the culmination of God's plan, but just centering it still all the talk around Jesus, and here's why he was doing it, and here's what it accomplished, and here's what he did in his life for us, and here's what his death and resurrection accomplished for us. So I think that could be good. Yeah, and then you're centering it around there. Yeah, right.
That was the first question I had.
Right, okay. The first question.
If they don't believe in God,
right,
then you're really not going to get anywhere.
Right.
But if you know, say, do you believe in God?
Right.
But anything that if they acknowledge that,
right,
then you've got a foundation,
right,
that you can work on.
Uh-huh. Right.
What we did find is that there's so many bunny trails.
Yes.
That you can go down.
Right.
And wasted the whole 5 minutes.
Yes, exactly. And that's why thinking through and developing, and so by the time we get to the end of this, I want each of you to have your sort of concise, here are the points I always want to hit without getting distracted and running in a million different directions. I want to hit these. So whether it's what Karen was just talking about with keeping it around Jesus, and here's why he came, here's what he did in his life, and what he showed us how to live, he did these things, and here's what he accomplished in his death and resurrection. If you want to keep it there, or if you want to go with something more like creation, fall, redemption, restoration, which is a little broader, zoomed out, but having those clear points of these I know I want to cover without getting distracted, and developing a very simple, concise way to do that, I think is a good step.
I found myself kind of stumbling over my own words because when I started with the words Jesus and Son and God and Father came out of my mouth, I was recognizing as those words were coming out of my mouth that could be thoroughly confused.
Yep.
And so I transitioned to God restoring humanity to himself and made the case for Jesus.
Right. Yeah. Right. 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 Yeah. And yeah, keeping in mind, everything you say has to be true. Everything that's true doesn't have to be said. Okay? So think about that. Because just imagine, like when Kim is saying, like the Holy Spirit came and he's living in me. How does that sound to someone that has no kind? It's going to be hard to be taken seriously because that sounds so bizarre. So I don't think we're demeaning God or we're demeaning the Holy Spirit by not giving that as part of our explanation. That's just confusing. They're not thinking of a being that's pure spirit, that exists eternally, that's not physical, that's not in time. They're not thinking like that. So once you start to say, oh, well, God the Holy Spirit or God the Son, or there's no way they could possibly understand that properly, because they only are going to be Christians already have enough trouble thinking about God other than a human without a body or Jesus in the flesh. So if we have trouble thinking of outside of that, then there's no way that someone who's never really thought through it and has gotten whatever they have from our society is going to understand that. So when you say that, it's true that the Holy Spirit is living in Kim. I don't deny that, but I don't know how that has almost any value. So I would even, in explaining, like, let's say, I would want to say that God empowers us to, once we're saved, God empowers us to be able to live a different way. We have a strength to resist sin that we couldn't necessarily before. Now, how does that happen? Well, because the Holy Spirit is living. But I don't, again, everything you say has to be true, but you don't have to say everything that is true. So think wisely about what do you leave out, what do you simplify, not because you're trying to duck it or not, you know, whatever, but because it's just not going to work. It's not going to make any sense. Uh-huh.
They wear these robes.
Yeah.
Have churches that look like this.
Right.
Because the human mind is so hung up on the visual and the external.
Yep.
They get really, really messed up with, well, who's right? I mean, all these denominations.
Right.
All these Bible translations.
Right.
Which one's the right one?
Right.
Where do you go with that?
Yeah, so, I mean, that's a great segue to say, well, okay, so yeah, there's a lot of differences in certain particular aspects, but here's the core that at least should be the common thread amongst these. Now, this is where we can be, each of us individually, but we can see if we would zoom out and look at certain segments of the church more broadly, is what are you emphasizing? And this is the problem with a denomination is only a problem, the difference, if what they focus on and what they're all about is their particular kind of unique thing. So Calvinism is not a problem unless you make Calvinism the whole thing of Christianity. All you talk about, all you care about, all you communicate about is Calvinism or gifts of the Spirit, right? I tend to be a little less, I'm not a cessationist, but I trend a little towards, I don't expect that as much, especially in our society. But I don't have a problem with it as such, and I don't have a problem with people who are more charismatic as long as they don't make everything about speaking in tongues. At that point, even if speaking in tongues is legit and the gift that is supposed to, whatever, I know that that's not what it's supposed to be all about. I know that even if it's true that we still have that gift is still in the church and that every one of us has the power to speak in tongues, I know that's still not the core message of Christianity. That's still not the core of the gospel. Social justice, this fits in. Is it wrong to serve the poor, to the orphan and widow? No, in fact, we should be doing that. But that's still not the gospel. So if that replaces the gospel, and if all our church ever talks about is that, now I can say that's a problem. So that can be where maybe we can say, even to front load it, you know, while there is this common core of basic Christianity, and here's what, and I'll explain what that is. What can be confusing is that often people emphasize, and what you see them mostly talking about or expressing is the things that are different, and you don't see as much emphasis on the things that are the core. But it's often there. I can show you how it's there most of the time. We could critique whether it is in all the circumstances. You know, so someone with the Catholic upbringing, they're going to think, okay, you have to do these certain things, right? And it's about what you did, or it's about the Eucharist. Well, what is the Eucharist about, right? And they may not even know. So it's, we often, different denominations get caught up so much in their thing that makes them unique that it becomes what they're about and what they express, and they don't emphasize that core. But it's not that they deny it. It's not that it's not there usually. Individual to individual it might be. But as a denomination, they're not rejecting that core. It's that they're spending too much time emphasizing, which is why I'll have those discussions, but we need to get back to what is the core, and that's what we should be emphasizing the most. It's what I think makes this church unique is I think we have a pretty broad spectrum on a lot of those issues. But what we're mostly focused on is that core that's the same, so we don't have the conflicts other churches do, where it's all about the conflict on this issue. You know, in the Southern Baptist Church, there's this big kind of battle going on right now with Calvinists and Arminians and people that don't care and whatever, and there's this sort of war being waged. And I'm not even going to say there aren't even good reasons behind some, but it's a lot of emphasis is on that issue, and I think we have an advantage in that the reason we can be kind of united as one local body here is that while we have those differences and we can talk about those, what we emphasize is more of that core. So it's not a problem. It's only when you start to emphasize those external, the kind of fringe things, and make those what it's all about. Now we have a problem, because if you don't think the same way, but that's what most of the conversation is about, now you're an outlier. So you're either going to fight or be convinced, or you're going to leave eventually. So anything else? I know we're probably way over here. Okay. Oh, go ahead. One more. Uh-huh. Right. Sure. Right. Right. Music, right. 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 Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, and maybe that's a good way to think about it, is could God delight in this difference being expressed in the body or not? So a different gospel, God doesn't delight in. There's no delighting in a different gospel. So if we're making this the gospel, whatever our particular thing is, then no, that's a problem. But if we're making, if we're staying focused on the gospel and expressing in certain different ways, then yeah, that's not a problem, right? I think that's a good way to think about it. All right, we'll wrap up for this week, and then we'll reconvene next week, and we can go more in depth here. And I think we'll continue to sprinkle in some of the videos as we go, because it's good for, it gives a good context to think about it differently, but then we'll be working more and more on how are we expressing these things? How are we addressing certain questions and improving our ability to do better if we end up in that circumstance? So thanks, guys.